Right. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. Sorry about the room mix-up today. I'm glad you all made it here. As always, we're grateful to the British Society of Aesthetics for their continued support of this series of talks, and very pleased to have Sonia Sedeby from the University of Toronto speaking today. Sonia is chair of the department at the Scarborough campus. Many of you will know her work from the British Journal of Aesthetics, Journal of Aesthetics and Art Criticism, a recent book published several years ago with Bloomsbury. And her title today is The Puzzle of Make-Believe About Pictures. Can One Imagine a Perception to Be Different? Over to you, Sonia.
Hi. So thanks very much for having me. This is very much an exploratory paper. So I welcome criticisms at the end very much. What I'm going to be doing is I'm going to examine the proposal at the heart of Kendall Walton's make-believe approach to pictures, that when we see a picture, we imagine seeing what a picture depicts. Now I'm going to do this by considering how well it works with the main competing approaches to perception that have crystallized since he formulated his approach. And we'll see that Walton explicitly invokes a specific theory of perception, namely that perception is contentful in developing and defending his account. So I just want to be clear about that, that I'm not foisting philosophy of perception on Walton. He commits to a very particular one, and so it is, I think, appropriate and important to examine his theory in light of the very terms that he actually invokes and commits to. Now, I think his aim is twofold with respect to pictures. He wants to satisfy our intuitive view that pictures are a matter of our visual perception somehow, right, to make good on this intuition, and to show that this can be accommodated within his make-believe framework for the representational arts. Now, the make-believe framework holds that representational works are props that draw us to participate in games of make-believe. And so what this means is that he's got to explain how perception and imagination can cooperate in specifically perceptual games of make-believe, as he would put it, both evoked and licensed by pictures. Okay, so now his key proposal is, this is really at the heart of what he's doing, is that a picture doesn't make one imagine what it is of, for example, ships on the sea. Rather, it makes one imagine seeing ships on the high seas. And he has a very specific, almost technical, almost formal way of cashing this out that he commits to, that one imagines of one's perceptual experience of the canvas, that it is a different perceptual experience, for example, seeing ships on the high seas. And I'm going to be trying to see whether he can deliver this, because I think he's got to deliver this. This is what, in his terms, he has to be able to do. Okay, so now he insists that the make-believe experience of a picture is a single, unified, complex whole. Only if we can get this, that it is single and unified experience, do we get it right. And he proposes that this complex unity can be explained by two facts about perception. That perception is contentful, and I will offer quotes to this effect, and that perception is penetrated by thought, which includes imaginative thought as well as other capacities. And so that's the explicit connection to philosophy of perception right there. He is committing to one of the dominant approaches. Now, the thing is that over the last 30 years, since Walton's formulated his work, philosophy of perception has been concerned not only with explaining the nature of perceptual contents, and this is just an explosive area, but also not just with contents, but also with the role of objects in perception, and in explaining that somehow perception is special in engaging us with objects. So three approaches, I would say, I'm not unique in this, have crystallized. One is that perception is purely contentful, and I will explain these momentarily, that it is purely relational, it just relates us to objects, no contents involved, and then a small minority of people who are trying to argue for a hybrid view, that you can have both contents and relations. Okay, sorry, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through in four steps. The first step will be to present Walton's theory and to try to show in more detail the way I've reconstructed it. And I'm going to present these three approaches to perception, and then I'm going to put the two together to see how Walton's approach fares with each of these sort of families of approaches, and then I'll look at implications at the very end. Okay, so So I think we all know that Walton's overarching proposal is that representations are objects that have the socially contextual function to draw us into imaginative games of make-believe as participants who imagine what a work makes fictional. That's a big mouthful. That's the overall framework that should more or less do for any kind. So now what about depictions? Depictions are things whose function in a given social setting is to serve as props in sufficiently rich and vivid perceptual games of make-believe. And this means that we need to explain depiction in terms of participation in visual games of make-believe, participation that involves an experience that is both imaginative and visual. Okay, so that's the task. So what do we have to do? What does Walton have to do? He has to explain distinctively perceptual games of make-believe, right? That's what he's trying to do. So he writes a bunch about Meindert Hobbema's The Watermill with the Great Red Roof, and here are two quotes. "The spectator imagines seeing a mill, and also imagines her actual perceiving of the picture to be her perceiving of a mill. These elements are integrated into a single experience, which is at once imaginative and genuinely visual. It is this experience that makes depiction special among the various modes of representation, and especially visual." Okay, one more. "Consider a game in which it is fictional that he, the viewer, sees a red-roofed mill. As a participant in the game, he imagines that this is so. This self-imagining is done in a first-person manner. He imagines seeing a mill, not just that he sees one, not just that he sees one. And he imagines this from the inside. His actual act of looking at the painting is what makes it fictional that he looks at a mill. And this act is such that fictionally it itself is his looking at a mill. He imagines of his looking that its object is a mill." And there's that formulation. It comes up again and again. That's basically what the theory comes to. "One does not first perceive Hobbema's picture and then in a separate act imagine that perception to be of a mill. The phenomenal character of the perception is inseparable from the imagining which takes it as an object." Okay? All right. So there's that formulation. One more time, "She imagines her actual perceiving of the canvas to be an act of perceiving mill. So now what we can see from the very precise formulation is that he's insisting on two things. The object of the imaginative thought is a perception, the perception of a painting, and the object of the imaginative thought figures de re, which on a standard view of Dehre thought means that the truth or accuracy of the imaginative thought, the one that's taking the seeing of the canvas, depends on what the perception is in res, actually, independently of any specification or anything that the viewer may think about it. Okay, so now why insist on the unity of the experience, this strange unity, yes? Walton gives us two reasons. The first one is that this distinguishes pictures from textual fictions. Okay, and here's Walton. Although the reader of a description of Emma Bovary in that fictional text may imagine seeing Emma, he does not imagine his actual perceptual act to be a perceiving of her. The actual perceptual act is of a page, right? Nor is his actual visual experience of the words on a page penetrated by the thought that Emma is what he sees. Thus does depiction differ from verbal representation and from description generally. So this structure is crucial for him for distinguishing depictions from descriptions. But he gives another reason, which I don't think gets much airtime, and I think it's interesting and important, and that is that it's this unity that he's positing that explains the profound effect pictures can have on us. And here he uses as his example Van Gogh's lithograph of sorrow, and I've got the whole quotation here. Rather than merely standing outside Van Gogh's lithograph and imagining what it depicts, imagining a sorrowful woman sitting hunched with her head and arms resting on her knees, I imagine seeing her and observing her sorrow. This leads to imagining feeling about her and for her and perhaps with her in ways that enable me imaginatively to understand her sorrow. Thus I come to understand what it is like to feel this way. None of this would be possible if pictures were simply imitations of visual forms, or if they were just signs signifying or standing for things of the kind they represent. None of this would be possible if pictures were not, like hobby horses, props and games of make-believe in which people participate visually and also psychologically, because it's only if you're in a mental state can that state be penetrated by other states. I think that's the idea. So this is his sort of twofold reasoning for insisting on this very complicated complicated unity. And as I've just said, he thinks it's achieved by cognitive penetration. He makes this very explicit, for example, in this passage. I do not mean just that thoughts have causal effects on one's experiences, but that the experiences contain thoughts. Imagining also, like thoughts of other kinds, enter into visual experiences. And the imaginings called for when one looks at a picture inform the experience of looking at it. The seeing and imagining are inseparably bound together, integrated into a single complex phenomenological whole. And they must be thus integrated if the picture is to qualify as a picture. Okay, so he's insisting that the connection between the seeing and the imaginative seeing cannot be external, cannot be causal, cannot be additive in some sense. Okay, all right, so what about the perception is contentful part? This comes out really explicitly in an exchange that Walton has with Volheim. I'm going to go through it because I think that Volheim's objection is interesting in its own right because he's basically objecting to the very thing that I'm highlighting. But Volheim's objection is intuitive and it's undeveloped. So let's look at the objection that Volheim gives and then we'll see that Walton explicitly commits to contents in addressing Volheim. So here's Volheim. My difficulty is how to understand the core project of imagining one perceptual experience to be another. if we succeed, in what way does the original experience retain its content? What is left of the experience of seeing the surface when I successfully imagine it to be some other experience? However, if I do continue to see the surface, or this experience retains its content, how have I succeeded in imagining it, the experience, to be an experience of seeing a face, for example? So, completely intuitive. Now, he goes on to make an important point that I'm going to read, which is that this whole problem is unique to trying to combine two perceptions, an actual perception and an imagined perception. So here he is. Note that this problem arises exclusively where, one, what we imagine to be something different from what it is something perceptual. Two, what we imagine it to be is also something perceptual. There is clearly no fundamental difficulty in my moving my hands and arms in a regular and jerky fashion and imagining of it that I'm conducting some great orchestra. Nor, for that matter, in my looking hard at an old enemy and imagining of it that I'm burning him up with my gaze. In the first case, neither experience is perceptual. In the second, only one is perceptual. Okay, so it's specific to this case that his intuition is that there's some real problem. But beyond this, he doesn't develop what the problem is. Okay, so Walton's reply is to deny this, basically. So let's see, Walton, characteristically, this does not seem to me to be a problem at all. Why should imagining a perceptual experience to have one content, right, here he goes, to have one content while recognizing that it actually has a different one be any more difficult than imagining an object to have properties different from those one realizes it really possesses, imagining a glob of mud to be a pie, for example. Now, he then gives a whole bunch of examples. I don't think those are all that great. And then he returns to making the point in terms of contents. In all of these examples, not only is the actual object of a person's perceptual experience in fact different from what she imagines it to be, and not only does she know this to be so, it is likely that the actual intentional content of her experience is different from what she imagines it to be. That is, the original experience retains its content even as she imagines it to have a different content. Okay, so this is totally driven in terms of contents. And if we went back to the Volheim passage, you can see he's formulating his objection in terms of contents as well. So they both share the view that perception is contentful. They both share the view that perception is cognitively penetrated, right? It is constitutively affected by our thoughts. And where they differ is that one thinks that intentional perceptual contents can be sufficiently complex to be what Walton is suggesting and Volheim doesn't. So they're really disagreeing in a way about the nature of perceptual content, right? One's denying, one is affirming. Okay? Alrighty, so now I'm going to move to theories of perception. I hope this is okay. I will sort of try to, make it bearable. Sometimes contemporary theory of perception is unbearable even for those of us who do it. I definitely subscribe to that. So the first family of views are pure content views, and what's a content? Well, the content of a representation is of the way things are, where things might not be that way. Well, that's just the intuitive notion. A belief, text, or picture might represent that the sun is setting behind certain ships at sea, though the sun might be rising behind those ships instead, so that the way that the belief or picture or perception represents the world to be is not correct. Yes? And really, the question at issue these days is this what perceptions do? Right? Is this just the right way to understand perceptions? And just one thing to note is that contents are individuated in terms of the conditions that would obtain for them to be true or accurate. Yes, that's what it is for there to be a content. That's how we identify them. Okay, so there's two, I'm going to divide it into broadly two varieties. And this is what I think either one of these is what Wolheim and Walton, I'm guessing, would have been thinking in terms of. So there's what's called Russellian or weakly Russellian contents, and these are existentially quantified contents that specify and are satisfied by objects. I don't know how many people took baby logic or have any left in your memory banks. So intuitively, an existentially quantified content is just when you say something like, there is a brightly colored canvas, or there is a glass of water. I'm going to, for each of these theories, do kind of a sort of, not really formalization, but regimentation, just to try to bring out what I think is at issue. So if we go to the logic of it, we have there's an X such that X is P, right? There is an X such that X is a glass. So there is, and normally we say there is at least one thing, right? So put it more intuitively, I hope, there is at least one thing, and it is a canvas and brightly colored. Or there is at least one thing, it is a seeing, and it is of a brightly colored canvas, right? So whatever you're predicating, you just keep adding it in there. So that's an existentially quantified content. And part of the point is that you're specifying some conditions, and objects out there either meet them or not. And the consequence of this, one of the consequences is that the content stays the same whether the object exists or not. I could say there is a glass of water, and if there were no glasses of water in the universe, that content would stand. It does not constitutively depend on the existence or presence of the object. Yes, does that seem right? Okay, so now Frege-ian contents consist in what are called de dicto modes of presentation that again specify and are satisfied by object. So what's a mode of presentation? It's just what you understand as you pick out something. So it's what you understand about a type of object that helps you to pick it out. So it's my understanding of glasses of water that helps me to pick up glasses of water. So here's just some intuitive examples. The canvas is brightly colored. Yes, I'm presenting a canvas, and I'm presenting that it's brightly colored. The picture is of ships on the high seas. The picture of ships on high seas is brightly colored, and we could do the same for seeing. The seeing is of a brightly colored canvas. The seeing is of ships on the high seas. Yes? So, and again, these kinds of contents don't depend constitutively on objects, right? If there was none of those things in the universe, those contents could stand if nothing satisfied them. Nothing satisfied those specifications. Yes? Okay, so now there was a big revolt, and people said, this is terrible, and for various reasons argued against content theories of perception and said no contents at all, just pure relations to objects. So I stand in something like a primitive referential or acquaintance relation to this, and this is constitutive for my perceptual experience. Unspecified, ununderstood, independently of anything that goes on with me cognitively, it's just some kind of whoosh, and we are connected. Okay? A logician or technical philosopher of mind might put, relation, subject, object, not very user-friendly. So what I'm going to try to do when I talk about relational perceptions or hybrid views, the arrow there is supposed to be the relation, and I've got an underline where the object is. So it's I'm not specifying the object. This is the object figuring in the experience. Yes, so relation, two-dimensional colored plane surface, or relation, brightly colored painting. And you can see that this is the antithesis of the pure content views, because all that's going on here is a relation, and the object itself is constitutive for the experience. So if there's no object, there is no experience. So if I'm looking like right here and an evil genius zaps the glass out of existence, poof goes my experience too. Okay? All right. So now there's people like me who want to have their cake and eat it too, or at least who think that the extremists are wrong. And these are the hybrid views. And you can use, again, this idea of Frege-ian modes of presentation or singular senses. The second one is very technical. I'm not really going to get into it. I just have it there for completeness. But so what's the idea? So the idea is that a mode of presentation can both specify an object and depend on it, right? For about 30 years, people have thought this was impossible. When people first started talking about this in the 1980s and 90s with John McDowell and Gareth Evans, the idea was, no, this is darkness. This cannot be such a thing. You cannot have a specification of an object that also depends on the object. So think about demonstratives. A demonstrative can help pick out an object, and in so doing, depend on it for its success. So let's say I want to say, this glass is filled with water. Well, this glass, you might say, is helping me pick out what's in the world, that the glass, as opposed to the watch, which is not filled with water, right? So my understanding of the kind of object helps me to relate to it, but if there were no glass here, I would fail. So it both helps you engage with the object, it offers some understanding to do it, and then it depends on it. And the upshot is that the experience is both contentful and relational, like this canvas has these colors. Yes, you cannot say that, and you can't make sense, and no one can understand you if there ain't such a canvas present to both of you and your listener, right? Okay, so there's just doing it, this canvas relation, these bright colors relation. Let's just forget singular when filled altogether. So now let's put Walton together. Why have I sort of gone through this exercise? So here's our favorite phrase. And let's look at pure content theories first. So Ahmed imagines of seeing the brightly colored canvas that it is a seeing of ships on the high seas. Can pure content theories deliver this? I think a Russellian theory has absolutely no problem. There is at least one thing, and it is a seeing of a brightly colored canvas, and an imagining of it, the seeing, that it is a seeing of ships on the high seas. Remember when, if I say, there is a glass filled with water, the Russellian says there is at least one thing. It is a glass, and it is filled with water. That's a complete unity. We haven't divided the glass into a glass and water just through this logical notation, and you can just keep building up ever more complex contents. That's just what this Russellian approach does for you. Does that seem right to people? So I think this would give Walton what he needs. I don't see a problem. There is at least one thing. It is a seeing of a brightly colored canvas, and it's an imagining that it is a seeing of ships on the high seas. Okay? What about the Phrygian? Seeing the brightly colored canvas is imagining of it that it is a seeing, that it is seeing ships on the high seas. Again, I don't see a problem if you have one mode of presentation and another kind of in a subject predicate structure, right? Seeing the brightly colored canvas is imagining of it something. I think it's very awkward linguistically. I actually have worked a lot on that formulation. I'm still not sure how good it sounds, but I think the idea that you've got a mode of presentation, two modes of presentation combining predicatively should give Walton what he needs. Okay, so relational theories. So I've divided them into two. Are we okay? So they divide in the following way. Whether the object that enters your experience is the complex object, right? The painting, the brightly colored painting, or just what low-level vision delivers. So colors, contours, and just the material object. Yes? So we've got the looks version, the complex object, a picture of ships on the high seas is constitutive for your experience, or the material object with low-level visual properties is the object of the primitive acquaintance relation. So you're acquainted to the brightly colored canvas. I think there's a problem on both views. And the problem is that on the first one, perceiving a picture is experiential, but Walton's insistence that the experience is integrated from two parts is lost, right? Because you just have the complex object constituting your experience, a single experience. So the complexity that Walton wants is not delivered. On the second one, where you're restricted to low-level vision at a location, basically, that's what you're related to, and everything else is cognition. A problem with that one is now we've got a conjunction, right? We've got an experience plus cognitive effects, such as belief or imagining, which is exactly what Walton wanted to avoid. He was trying to emphasize that there's a unique, unified experiential state, and the relationist divides it into a primitive and then all the cognitive effects. So I think on either way, even if we get as detailed as we want about the options that relational theorists work with, I think we can't get Walton's theory. So what are our results so far? Walton's view seems to do well on a pure content approach to perception. And you might be saying, well, so what? That's what he said in the first place. Why did I just go through all this? Well, I hope for at least the following two reasons. One, he never cashed it out. That exchange between him and Volheim, Walton gestures to intentional contents and the article ends, so he never cashed it out. And so what we've done is we've sort of made good that there is some theory out there which delivers the goods. And secondly, that I think Volheim's intuition did not bear fruit, at least insofar as it's an intuition about contents. Maybe the intuition was something else, right? He was talking about contents and he had some other intuitions, which is partly why I've gone into looking at objects, right? Object theories of perception, whether Volheim maybe was thinking something along those lines. But at least by going and looking at the pure content theories, I think we can I hope I've reconstructed what I think Walton had in mind, or at least what will deliver his view. And we see that it's not compatible with purely relational approaches. And, you know, in a way, this is a shame because we do increasingly think that objects and some relatedness to objects is important for understanding perception. So, you know, where are we? Are we going to say too bad for Walton, you know, or too bad for relational theories, right? Walton's right, relational theories are wrong, or relational theories are right, and Walton's got to be wrong. So that's why we're going to look at the hybrids, because I think the hybrids actually do nice work. I'm not sure if Walton was aware of this. I think he may have been, but that's something I need to actually kind of check out biographically. Certainly the literature was out there, so it would have been possible for him. So recall that a mode of presentation, or just simply one's understanding of a type of object, helps secure one's relation to it, right? It's my understanding of glasses that helps me pick this out as opposed to the bottle. So now let's look at our example and Walton's account of it. We would have something like this seeing of a canvas, which helps secure the relation, is this imagined seeing of these ships on the high seas relation. Or just this seeing relation, this imagined seeing relation. You can put the copula there or not. So it seems to me that hybrid content views can also deliver what Walton needs, and they can do it in a way that gives a role for objects. So I think that we can accommodate the cognitive penetration and contents which are necessary for Walton's view, and we can also satisfy this increasing commitment that perceptions engage us with objects and depend on them. Okay, so let's think about the implications of what we've done. So we've seen that Walton's view can be explained in terms of pure content theories. It is not compatible with pure relational theories. It can be explained in terms of hybrid theories. And now I want to cross-cut. I want to take a slightly different perspective. I've just been talking about kind of the three big divides in philosophy of perception today. There's another big divide. And the other big divide is whether perception is restricted to low-level vision. So all you really perceive are colors, contours, and, you know, I don't know if anything else is granted, but let's stick to colors and contours. And everything else is really a matter of cognition. So perception is now restricted to something like low-level vision, right? So only low-level properties are perceived. That is opposed by the view that perception can be of high-level properties as well. And I think we can see two things. Walton is committed to high-level approaches to perception, right? I mean, I actually think rereading Walton, he's really Kantian. I mean, when he, I didn't have this quote, but when he was writing about cognitive penetration, he said, you know, an imagination can color a perception just as a thought can color a perception, right? And so he just, I mean, the idea to me is, was a very clear echo, I thought, of this Kantian idea of just this constitutive internal relatedness of thought to perception. So he's really committed to high-level approaches to perception. So notice now that if a content theory restricts us to low-level properties, then Walton's view would not be compatible with it. So it isn't just a matter of content, but what kind of content whether you're going to be a theorist that countenances high-level properties or complicated high-level perception or not. So, and again, I think here we have this kind of situation where, you know, which way do we go? Do we go with Walton or philosophy of perception? I mean, on the one hand, Walton offers a tremendously powerful framework. So we might say, given the explanatory power, I mean, one might not agree with it, right? I have not said that it's right. What I'm saying is it's powerful. It is one enormous framework that subsumes a hell of a lot. Given such a framework, that is kind of, you know, a lot, that in itself means that it has a lot going for it. And so then you might say, well, so a theory of perception that's at odds with such a powerful framework for representation is in trouble. You can run it the other way. Philosophy of perception gets to dominate, and any view in philosophy of art that falls afoul of philosophy of perception is in trouble, right? So I think it can cut both ways. I just want to emphasize that I don't think philosophy of perception just gets to dominate for some reason, like because it's part of the philosophy of mind, right? Philosophy of art, especially one that gives you this vast framework, maybe should be telling philosophers of perception, hey guys, you know, get with the program, you want to explain art, well, you have to commit to high-level perception. You have to get away from relational views. I mean, you can run the argument that way as well. So I think it's a question how we want to go. Okay, so what about imagination? By looking at all this, have we learned anything about imagination? You know, I think what we've been doing by looking at Walton's theory is we've been asking or probing whether imagination can cognitively penetrate perception so that it's present in and colors a perceptual experience. I mean, that's kind of the challenge, really, in essence, that Walton is giving us in a very specific way. And, you know, it's pretty easy to say, well, it stands in an external relation to it, it stands in a causal relation to it, it's somehow additive. That's not hard, right? The question really is whether it is somehow internally integrated with it. And one thing we've seen is that, you know, the answer in part is constrained by theories of perception. Because we've seen that some theories of perception allow imagination to be integrated with perception, and some theories of perception deny it, yes? So content views and hybrid models allow that imagination can be unified with the perception in a single experiential state. And relational approaches hold that imaginative thought can be evoked by a perception and causally or externally related to it. But that's the restriction, okay? So I think that's one thing that I hope going through Walton like this shows. But I think that there's another thing we can get from Walton, and that is that context is important as well. So, like, I don't think that one can just take any perception and imagine it to be different. Okay, so maybe I'm very limited, but if I look at this black rectangle, I don't think that I can imagine of seeing the black rectangle that I'm seeing a flaming red one. I don't even know what that would be. I mean, maybe you could say that I can imagine that it is red. But it's a whole different ballgame, what Walton is insisting on, that you can imagine of the seeing of seeing the black rectangle, that it's a seeing a red rectangle. And what Walton has done is, you know, he's emphasized context. He has said only in some context where you have sufficiently enculturated viewers can this be the case, right? So what has he restricted us to? He's restricted us to children's vivid games of make-believe and pictures. Pictures which are objects specifically designed to evoke an act of imagining a perception of a different object given a suitable social setting. Right? They don't just do it by themselves. So I think this idea that you can imagine of an experience that it's different, it's not supposed to be kind of smeared all over the place. Right? Something you can do anytime with respect to anything. You know, and I don't know how big that set is. From Walton, I think we get vivid games of make-believe, perceptual games of make-believe. What are those? Those are in a social setting with specifically designed objects. And I don't know if there's anything else. Maybe thought experiments. I don't know. But so it's not just a humongous hypothesis about all kind of just a relationship between imagination and perception. So I have one other implication to talk about, but I don't know how I'm doing on time, whether I should save that for the discussion period.
You still have 10 minutes, more than 10 minutes.
Oh, really?
You don't need to go on for that one. But okay. If you'd like to, you're welcome to.
I've been racing. Mm. Okay, so this is very impressionistic. So this is what about Walton's account of aesthetic value? I kind of feel like there's some tension between the account of depiction that we just looked at really through a microscope, I think, and his view of aesthetic value, but maybe not. So I'm just gonna lay it out. So Walton suggests that aesthetic value is partly constituted by the pleasure we take in admiring something with propriety, yes? And judging it to be good. So it's not just that it pleases you, but what pleases you is judging that it's good and admiring it, right? So, you know, that distinguishes it just sort of from raw pleasure, right? He says it's intentional with an S, but anyway. So this distinguishes it from raw pleasure. It again brings in the notion of admiring something with propriety and saying that it's this very complex pleasure. Okay, and then immediately he adds an important restriction or qualification. Aesthetic pleasure is not just pleasure taken in my admiration of something, but in its getting me to admire it. Right? So let's say, you know, I admire this Turner very much and it gives me pleasure. So what's going on? It's that I am finding pleasure, not just in the painting, but in my own admiration of it. I'm really kind of, it's got that self-reflexivity to it, but also in my awareness of it, that it's getting me to admire it. Now, what that means, well, what is the it in the case of pictures? I mean, intuitively, I think we would say, well, obviously, it's the picture, the canvas, the way it's marked, the textures, the colors, what it's doing. It's getting me to admire it. Yes? But Walton's view of depiction is that seeing the canvas evokes an imaginative seeing of something else. He doesn't have anything to say about that initial seeing. Now, in part, he claims that that's in a way the power, again, of his view, because his view of sort of that first part, seeing the picture, he says, well, look, there's huge diversity of pictures. Maybe a lot of the proposals that we have can come in and work for different pictures. So I, Walton, or my theory, can subsume resemblance accounts, occlusion shape accounts, recognition accounts, whichever work better for the kind of picture we've got going. But in any case, there is no explanation in the theory of seeing the picture or of how the picture evokes the imaginative seeing. I mean, think about that word evoke, like it just happens, right? I mean, you see the picture and it evokes the imaginative seeing, and that's the phenomenological, qualitative, what it's like unity that we've been trying to unpack technically. So to me, it seems that anything he's got to say falls on the imaginative side, not on the perceiving the picture, how it gets me to do it side. It's not that he denies it. It's just that I don't see that the theory itself makes room for it, sort of gives us a space for how the picture gets me to admire it. Unless we go to the imaginative part, like we did at the outset with the lithograph of the sorrowful woman. Yes? I mean, there we've got the full complex experience, and maybe I can understand how it's getting me to admire it, because I can relate to, you know, the woman and her sorrow and whatever. But I don't really see how it's getting at the perceptual part. I may be wrong here, and I might not be somehow fully in the spirit of the view, but somehow it seems to me when I read Walton that all the emphasis is on the imaginative part of the experience, and the perception is just there to kind of hit you and evoke the imagination. And that's fine. It seems great when, you know, we're doing the depiction explanation, but I'm not sure that it's so comfortable when we want an explanation of how the picture gets me to admire it, which is supposed to be part of what it's being pleasurable to me and it's being aesthetically valuable to me. So at least that's how it seems to me. It seems to me that his whole emphasis and what he cares about, or maybe it's just because it's hard to explain, and so that's where his explanatory effort lies. It lies on the imaginative part, right? And that was the part that we spent all this time talking about, right? How you can imagine of something that it is something else. So that's the last implication that I just thought I might raise for discussion. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.